Welcome to How to Become a Leader in Africa, the podcast where we explore the fascinating logic behind leadership in African societies through conversations with Africans from all walks of life. I'm your host, Remy Adekoya. Let's dive into this week's discussion. Our guest today is the renowned Ghanaian Professor Audrey Gatsekpo, media practitioner, researcher, and former Dean of the School of Information and Communication Studies at the University of Ghana. She is currently the chair of the Ghana Center for Democratic Development. With over three decades of both practical and research experience in media, governance, and gender issues, she's uniquely positioned to help us answer a critical question: what kind of leadership does Africa need today? Professor Gatsekpo, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, and thanks for inviting me onto your show.
So, Prof, as you are Ghanaian and this podcast is about leadership, I'd love to start by asking you about J.J. Rawlings, who, while perhaps not as historical a leader as Kwame Nkrumah, was certainly one of the most memorable African leaders of my childhood years. So growing up in 1990s Nigeria, I remember how as 15, 16-year-old boys, we used to say we wish Nigeria had a leader like J.J. Rawlings. To us, he was an African hero, a patriot who had come to deliver justice in Ghana by getting rid of its corrupt politicians and genuinely working for the betterment of the people, with his faults and all. Compared to the irredeemably corrupt rulers Nigeria had at the time, we really envied you having J.J. Rawlings. These were, of course, the views of 15-year-old boys, but I think they spoke to a thirst for a certain archetype of leader in Africa that persists till today. The patriotic revolutionary, who is not in politics just to make themselves rich like the rest, but to upend the system and fight for the proverbial common man. So first of all, do you agree this archetype of leader is still desired among many, especially young Africans today? Are figures like Burkina Faso's current military ruler, Ibrahim Traoré, who seems quite popular with a lot of young Africans, is he a modern iteration of this archetype? And finally, on this point, what do you, Professor, make of J.J. Rawlings and his legacy?
Right. Thank you for that question. Very interesting question. I was smiling because I know how much Nigerians love J.J. Rawlings, and I've had a lot of discussions with my Nigerian friends. I think the last one was in Abuja just last year. Because I think that Nigerians have a very romanticized view of J.J. Rawlings that is not nuanced by the realities Ghanaians experience. And Ghanaians have a divided opinion on him. There's no question in my mind that Rawlings was hugely popular in Ghana as well, especially amongst a certain class of people, young people also. But And you are right in a certain sense that there's still a clamor for that archetype of leader in Africa, the action man who can get things done, the revolutionary who is there not for himself but to change the system. And it's an archetype. In reality, it's much more complex. In reality, Burkina Faso's Tuareg is much more complex. And I perhaps will unpack that. Let me start with J.J. Rawlings.
Yes.
No question, charismatic. He had the gift of the gab. He was rather dramatic. I mean, he could jump into gutters to clean, because, the gutters were clean. But populism, you see, especially when you're a head of state, you don't need to jump into the gutter. It's your policies that will ensure that the gutters don't get backed up. So you need to keep that in mind. I mean, we can all be very captivated, especially when we're young, with a certain actions. But we also have to sort of hold these charismatic leaders accountable and to scrutinize them a little bit more. Rawlings' legacy is a complex one. He fired our imagination. His rhetoric was of egalitarianism. He was for the common man, and all of that. And in a certain sense, he did feel passionately for people who, well, he was he believed in social justice, to some extent. However, he had two terms. He was a coup leader.
Yes,
He came into
1979.
power because, yes. So don't forget, he was a coup leader, and he came twice. Okay, and the first time it was because the whole country had almost come to a standstill. We were fed up with the military government. We accused them of corruption. The country wasn't functioning well and all of that. He captured our imagination. Then he left. And after 2 years of democratic rule, he staged another coup. Now that's
Yes,
where the problem
1981.
begins.
1981, yes.
Exactly. That's where the problem begins, because then why did he stage that coup? He didn't give democracy a chance the second time around in the view of many people before he jumped in and seized power. So you have to ask, what was that coup about? And then the realities of his government, both June 4th, 1979, but especially December 31st, 1981, were marked by really disturbing extrajudicial killings. Especially that, he was in power from 1981 until 1993, 93, and then remained in power after that anyways, but under a democratic regime.
To
So
2001,
and
yes.
the next, yes, so no, no, not, yeah, but the period 1981 to 1993 was marked by authoritarianism. He was authoritarian. By the end of that regime, we had what we called in Ghana a culture of silence. Dissent was silence, extrajudicial killings, particularly the most egregious, many, but the most egregious that captured the minds of people was when three justices of the court were abducted, and an army officer were abducted and killed by the regime. I mean, the regime denies it, but everybody understands that it couldn't have happened without the regime sanctioning it. There was
Yes.
also a lot of seizures of properties, destruction of people's lives, brutalization even of common people like market women, because market women were seen as hoarders and saboteurs of the economy, of course, wrongly so, and the markets were partly raised down. All of that people have forgotten, but for some Ghanaians, it still remains in their minds, and that's why for some Ghanaians, Rawlings is not an unblemished leader. And then, of course, he was in power for a very long time. Post democracy, he took off his army uniform and his had led a party. They dropped the P from the PNDC military regime. They became NDC, and he had two more terms. Okay. And in those 2 terms, under democratic rule, there were accountability issues. There were charges of corruption, just like you do get today. It's just a question of the extent. But Ghanaians will not judge his regime as a clean regime, particularly after democracy was achieved. We can also credit him, though, And it's partly because of the people crediting for at least finally agreeing that we would transition to democracy. There were factors, there were external and internal factors, but we must give him credit for agreeing to democratic transformation and largely ruling or governing as a democratic leader in the Fourth Republic. He did that. There were hiccups along the way. Some bad habits die hard, but
yes,
you know, we can credit him for that. And eventually, before we transition to democracy, stabilizing the Ghanaian economy and Ghana's political system, particularly because he didn't like some other African leaders seek a third term. The idea was floated a little bit in a very subtle manner, but the mood of the country was such that it became a non-starter, and he stepped down gracefully, even though of course he ordained his vice president Atta Mills to take over from him. He eventually fell out with Atta Mills, though, but I mean, we can give him that, and lived as a civilian for the rest of his life until he died a few years ago.
Interesting. And staying on the archetype issue, I think it was Maya Angelou who wrote it, that people will not remember what you said, they won't remember what you wrote, but they will remember how you made them feel. And going back to how Rawlings made us feel, like I say, as 15, 16-year-old boys, of course, who did not know the details of what was actually going on in Ghana, which you have just explained very well here, what Rawlings made me feel, I remember, was that, wow, ultimately, the good guys can beat the bad guys if they are determined enough. And there can be some form of justice. Because of the environment we were living in, where the corrupt generals were brazenly looting the treasury, and no one seemed able to do anything about it whatsoever. And so this was the environment we were growing up in. And I bring this up because I'm trying to get at why you may think that archetype may still be strong, why people desire that. Is it that sense we have that we just want somebody that will come in and bring in some basic level of justice into our societies? Just at least let us see the people who've been robbing us put in jail, suffer some kind of consequences. Do you think that is where it stems from? Or are there other factors that you think contribute to this desire, which I think we still have, if you agree with me, for that kind of, you know, patriotic revolutionary? What need do such leaders serve in our psyche?
The simple answer is dissatisfaction with democracy. You see, in the early 1990s, almost all African countries transitioned from autocratic governance, many of them military regimes, to democratic governance. And there was an expectation that democracy would deliver on certain things. Social justice, of course, but importantly for people, economic justice. You know, people would be lifted out of poverty, our countries will be better governed, our services will function well, electricity will not be going off, there'll be access to water, quality of life, you know? And that hasn't happened, you see? And what people feel, many people in Africa feel even more vulnerable than perhaps they did under military regimes. In reality, perhaps if you look at indices, you will see that there's been some countries, a lot of, I mean, Rwanda, for example, I guess, but in Ghana, I mean, in some countries, you see the indices suggest that there's been social development, there's been economic development. I mean, some countries like Ghana have moved from being lower middle-income countries. But people are not really feeling it in their pockets and in their lifestyles. And so people are thinking, particularly young people who don't have the nuanced experience, they didn't live through the pros and cons of living under military regimes. Military regimes are not accountable. Military regimes tend to be brutal regimes. Ghana, we experienced a curfew for a long time. Soldiers could easily beat you up on the streets. And some of that is happening in Burkina, Mali, and Niger as well, you know? But what do statistics tell us? When you look at Afrobarometer, now Afrobarometer is a very important gauge of what ordinary Africans think on a whole range of issues. Afrobarometer says that only 37% of Africans are satisfied with the way democracy works in their country.
Yeah.
And even fewer, about 30%, think their government is doing an adequate job of curbing corruption. A majority think that corruption is growing, it's not decreasing. So there is a democratic recession happening there, okay? And then people like Tuareg come and they go back to the inequalities in the global stage and colonialism, you know, very pan-African in rhetoric. Yeah. They thumb their nose at the French and all of that. And so they capture young people's imaginations. But with Tuareg also, don't forget that a lot of his cachet is being fueled by social media disinformation. So there's a disinformation campaign in social media about what Tuareg has been able to achieve for Burkina Faso in the short time that he's been there. So it is not true. But for young people who are looking for change, you know, it's very, very seductive.
Yeah.
Now, I think we should also remember that still, in spite of the disenchantment with democracy, again, I come back to Afrobarometer. The latest results show that majority of Africans still prefer democracy over
any
other
system.
Kind of government.
Yes. I saw that. Yeah, I saw that survey. Yes.
Yes, you know. And they reject non-democratic alternatives, you know. But what people want is that our democracy must work.
Must work.
They want more accountable governance, okay? So they want more accountability. They want more effectiveness from their political leaders. So that's what's going on here.
And if we focus on Ghana then today, What kind of leadership, what kind of leaders do you think Ghanaians today crave?
I think Ghanaians want leaders that are effective in delivering the goods, okay? So again, you see that in Ghana, there's a lot of admiration for Rwanda, for Kagame.
For Kagame, yeah.
Never mind that. Yes, because never mind that Ghanaians believe in democracy. Majority of Ghanaians want term limits. Kagame does not represent term limits, you know. Ghanaians want a democratic system of government where they are not silent. So Ghanaians would revolt if they think that government was trampling on their rights. They would, they would protest, you know. But still, they admire Kagame. And for the simple reason that Rwanda seems to have made progress. So they'll say Rwanda is the cleanest African country, for example. Yeah. Rwanda, you know, so Rwanda is functioning. And that's the bottom line. That's the kind of leader they want. I think that we want a visionary leader, you know, also. We want a visionary leader. We want an effective leader who can make sure that our lives are improved. Visionary comes back to people like Nkrumah, right, where they had a big vision of where Africa ought to be and took steps to see that Africa would get there, particularly trying to get us more independent. And I don't, it's not political independence because we have political independence, but, you know, again, in the global arrangement, economic independence, you know, we're not beholden to the IMF, you know, because when we go to the IMF cap in hand, it means that there are conditionalities and we don't like the conditionalities. And often our social programs and social safety nets suffer with conditionalities.
Interesting. And if it comes to the quality of the leadership class in Ghana today, how would you assess that more or less, taking into consideration that, of course, no leadership class anywhere in the world is perfect, and we see examples of that even in some of the richest and most economically developed countries in the world. But how would you assess the process of leadership selection in Ghana? And by that, I mean the kind of people, the quality of people who tend to rise to the top and then become ministers and, of course, potentially president. How do you assess that process in Ghana?
In Ghana, like in many other African countries, and I suspect in many other countries of the world, we have a competitive political system, the democratic political system, that sometimes produces people who are popular rather than people who are, shall I say, capable. And I don't mean any particular political regime. I'm just saying, generally speaking, that's the nature of politics, right? We, I think, have had since our fourth republic, we've alternated power several times, alternated political parties. We have two dominant political parties. And we think that we are beginning to think that they have the same instincts. They all come from the same mother, in quotes, you know. And I think it's that the political culture is such that it tends to produce, let's say, in our parliaments, a mixed bag of people. And it's a mix, and maybe it's okay that it's a mixed bag, but it's a mixed bag of people that are very competent, very, very capable people in our political space. However, increasingly, I am beginning to see a deterioration of the quality of people in our parliaments, because it's money that is talking, it's patronage that is talking. Even though we don't have it as entrenched as Nigeria, it's political godfatherism that is talking. We have it to a lesser extent, but yes, people who are well connected, whether they've done a good job or not, and then also, I think that as citizens, we are not holding our politicians accountable enough. We hold them accountable in a general or every 4 years, we punish one, but we choose between the lesser of two evils. You see, we and this past election was a good example where many people were not sure who to vote for because they were absolutely upset with the last government. They they saw that government had failed on many fronts. And their choice was to bring back a political leader that they had rejected before, 8 years before. So we were between the devil and the deep blue sea, as they say.
Yes.
So it was a lesser of two evils that prevailed. People wanted to punish the last government for doing a poor job and the only option, because we're basically a two-party country. In fact, the minority parties are getting less and less relevant. You know, they don't represent a third force with any possibilities of even having people in parliament, let alone being alternate to power. And therefore, really, we're stuck between the two. The New Patriotic Party that just left office, NPP for short, and the New Democratic Congress, NDC for short, that is currently in power.
Hope you're enjoying the podcast so far. If so, please remember to like, subscribe, and share. You can also follow me on Twitter at Remy Adekoya 1. Let's get back to the podcast. And speaking, you mentioned here the role of popularity. You said there are some politicians who, you know, become popular, but they are not necessarily the most competent, but they get into office because people like them, they're popular, they get votes, etc. I think this could take us smoothly to the issue of the role of the media in politics and in leadership. And you're, of course, a huge media expert. And so if we look at this, at the role of the media, from Nkrumah's legendary radio broadcast to today's Twitter presidencies, how much of a role do you think the media has played in creating and popularizing African leaders? And do you think social media is a fundamental game changer in this sphere, or perhaps not really? What has it changed? Well, how would you describe those links?
Yeah, the media, of course, always has, and for the foreseeable future, will play an influential role in who becomes a leader in Africa. The other player when it comes to Africa are those who can effect coup d'etats. But let's say in the democratic dispensation, for example, you know, the media is still very important, both the legacy media and social media, because you see, they play what we call normative roles. You know, they provide information. So the quality of their information, how well they are able to inform us about what's going on, you know, influences the decisions we as citizens make, you know, whether to vote for somebody or not, or whether to hold somebody accountable or not, what to think of the government. Their watchdog role, as you know, really key. And so what's the level of investigative reporting, and are they able to investigate wrongdoing within society? And I don't mean just in politics, but the other power centers in society, are they able to do that job well? And if they do that job well, then, and if you have a responsive government, which again in itself is a challenge, then you can see some shifts. I mean, you don't only need a responsive government, but you need citizens who, when they read something in the media and they're unhappy, they show their unhappiness in a number of ways. They could, for example, go and demonstrate. So, for example, if the media does a good job reporting about an unfair tax, for example, a good analysis, based on that, people can decide that they're going to demonstrate. Or, as has happened in Ghana, media reports on the scourge of galamsey, not just media, I'm not attributing it all to the media, but the media has played a very important role in showing how our river bodies are being contaminated. There's loads of articles have been done on Galamsey, which is illegal mining and all of that, yeah. You know, and towards the end of last year and before elections, you know, there were young people demonstrating, wanting to be sure, wanting something done about Galamsey, and also wanting the government to be more accountable, okay? So the media can continue to play a role in that. Then also when they play a monitorial role, so they monitor what's going on. So mm-hmm. they flag problems, even if we don't know it exists, and they flag yes. it and they keep on it. Mm-hmm. And then when it gains traction also in social media. Now, social media is a game changer in good and bad ways. Mm-hmm. In good ways, if social media is to be seen in a positive light, is the fact that other people, not just the traditional media and the traditional gatekeepers, can bring issues to the fore, you know, and flag mm-hmm. it in the public space and bring it to our attention, mm-hmm. you know, especially if they do a good job really bringing out things that the political elite may want hidden, or the business elite. It's not, the politicians are not our only problems, yes. problem, you know. And then mm-hmm. if we have a robust civil society that works with the media, it mm-hmm. also brings a lot of traction, you see, because then they can support the media in advocacy as well. And, but you see, the way the media, the traditional media works, they move from one issue to the other because news is often breaking, and then they are, so they sort of, and that's the weakness, they sort of don't stay on one issue for very long. And sometimes some yeah. issues need you to stay on it. But also, mm-hmm. also we know that the media, at least in Ghana, you know, mm-hmm. are not very well endowed. mm-hmm. A lot of them are struggling, you know. Yeah. The media support, which used to come, legacy media, which used to come mostly from advertising, has shifted, yeah. you know. So yeah. there's less advertising money to support media. A lot of advertising money is going online, for example. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And because there are all kinds of advantages, target advertising, for mm-hmm. example, for advertisers. And so, you know, legacy media is really struggling, and that's the problem, because, yeah. you know, like I said, social media can be very misleading. There's no accountability. You know, sometimes things we read on social media are fake many times, not just sometimes. Yeah. We don't yeah. know where it originated from, but it's gone viral. Mm-hmm. Okay. Mm-hmm. And it's very difficult to counter those. We've seen even in mature democracies how social media has made a difference in their elections, you know.
Of course.
And so
of
course. So for us, that's an issue. But they're still very influential, particularly I still insist that legacy media is still very important, because we need honest brokers, you know. That's not mm-hmm. to say that we don't have partisan media. We do have partisan media. Mm-hmm. We have media that are not accountable. We have media that can be bought or co-opted. Mm-hmm. But we also have media in many of our countries that can speak truth to power, and that can inform people in ways that give them the right information, especially if people are minded to look for the right information. They can validate information, and they can discredit information. So we need the media.
And staying on social media now and the dynamics that may or may not have changed, if we're talking about entry into politics, so there's a 20-year-old or there's a 25-year-old in Ghana, for instance, who has ambitions of getting into politics, but they don't come from any well-known political family. They don't have so-called political connections. Getting into politics without any of that, or without having that political godfather, say 20, 30 years ago, was essentially impossible. If you didn't either come from a family that had the connections, or if you didn't have the connections yourself, or if you didn't stumble across a godfather, or rather the godfather stumble across you, there was no way you could enter into politics. Has that changed in Ghana? Is it now the case that a 25-year-old, say, who does not have mega connections, or let's say even a 30-year-old who does not have mega connections, can enter Ghanaian politics today thanks to media, or not necessarily? Thanks to social media, sorry.
I think in Ghana, it has always been possible for people who are not as well-heeled as others to get into politics, people who don't necessarily have godfathers to get into politics.
So that's different from Nigeria.
I wouldn't say it was impossible. There's just so many people who've gone into politics and didn't have the kind of backing that may have been needed in let's say Nigeria, and they've made it, including women. You know, so that's not, yeah. But I also think that for those who are social media savvy, it can increase their fortunes, particularly amongst younger voters. Older voters are not so much on social media, but younger voters are. And increasingly, you know, more and more voters are swayed by things that they read in social media, especially, I mean, on WhatsApp, for example, you know. It can flag up things that people may not know, and that can affect how they vote. So social media is important. I don't think that social media alone can sway your fortunes. You still, in the end, need to be able to go and talk to people. Face to face. I mean, you need to be able to campaign, you know, and let people see you and not just know of you in social media.
Interesting.
But it can take you far. Yeah.
Interesting. And I find it hugely fascinating that you say, and encouraging, that you say that actually there hasn't ever been that kind of huge barrier entering politics for people who may not necessarily have the connections or even the finances in Ghana. That's amazing. And perhaps it's one of the reasons.
What about the finances you need?
Yeah. Okay.
And increasingly, you don't need a godfather, but you need finances.
Okay.
And increasingly, that's the worry, actually. Increasingly, that's the worry. And so we may get to your levels, in the sense that, you know, primaries are getting more and more expensive, you know, and you have to win the primaries in order to compete on the national level. So of even course. Primary races are being monetized. Politics is being monetized in many African countries, including Ghana, and that's the bad news.
Interesting. And one thing you said really caught my interest. You talked about how even if you are visible on social media, if you want to get into politics in Ghana, you still have to go out and talk to people, you said. And we spoke at the beginning when you talked about Rawlings, about how he had that connection with people and was able to talk to people. Are there any kinds of personality types or kinds of character types that you think tend to resonate more with regular Ghanaians when it comes to who they like, who becomes popular, and the kind of person they will say, oh, yes, that is a leader?
I think, I don't know that there's one type of person. I haven't really thought about this. But I do think that For all leaders, you need a lot of charisma. You need to be able to talk, you know, and capture people's imaginations, you know. A bit of populism goes a long way. You also need to be seen as having humility. You know, I think that people in Ghana don't like arrogant people. They don't like, yes, they like to feel that they are heard. They like to think that even though I know that there's a power dynamic that doesn't favor me, you respect me, you see? So the kind of politicians who, a politician who will call an ordinary person boss, for example, goes a long way. And that's how we talk, you know? You're calling people who you obviously, the hierarchy shows that you obviously have a higher hierarchy, social hierarchy than them, but you are, you know, boss, chief, and that sort of thing. You know,
interesting.
But yeah, people don't like to be patronized, and I think that Ghanaians don't like to be patronized.
So very interesting. I'm sorry if I'm interrupted. I didn't want to, but I just found it really interesting. So essentially, you are saying Ghanaians like people who, even when they're in a higher position on the social hierarchy ladder, sort of bring themselves down, quote unquote, and are humble, at least rhetorically and in behavior.
Yeah, that's why we love Rollins. He seemed like an ordinary person, just like you and me. So we like that kind of person, and I think we also like people who, well, increasingly, people who we think are God fearing in quotes, you know. And so, you know, the religious, many of our politicians pander to religious leaders, religious congregations, particularly during election periods, because of that.
Sure. It's not, it's probably not so surprising, considering I saw a survey some time ago that religion is important for 90% of Africans. So there was, I think it was Pew Research did a survey asking people a question, how important is religion in your everyday life? And by far, it was most important for Africans. I think 90% of Africans across all countries. And in most countries, it's somewhere between 85 to 95% of people who said, yes, religion is an important part of my everyday life. No other continent came even close. I think the closest was South America, but it was quite a distant second. So I'm not, that's not, we know the role religion plays in the lives of everyday people in Africa. And moving on to something else, which you have a lot of expertise on. In your research and advocacy, you've spoken a lot about female representation in leadership positions, in media and politics, in Ghana and more broadly in Africa. What do you think this underrepresentation of females in leadership positions in politics and media, what does this say about the deeper structures of leadership and power in Ghana and across Africa more broadly, in your view?
I think that it goes back to legacies of the past, and including the recent past, where our societies, well, they still are. We live in patriarchal societies that have discriminated against women in the formal space, okay? In workplaces, in education. So if you think back not too long, a few decades ago, you know, we inherited, and part of it has been the colonial inheritance, and mixed with religious ideologies. Women were supposed to be confined in certain ways, even in the subjects that they studied, if they were to go to school, or really, if you have scarce resources, why are you educating a woman? Well, she'll go and get married. You know, women are supposed to get married, have children. And so there was a huge deficit there. There had to be campaigns, advocacy, in order to get the girl child educated, for example. Okay, so I'm starting from, let's say, education. Why? Because often in the present, in contemporary times, they'll say, but where are the women? If you want women to occupy this leadership position, are there women to occupy those leadership positions? In the past, it may be there are few women, and there are few women because society discriminated against women in terms of education, in terms of their positions in the workplace, in terms of the kinds of jobs that they were going to be able to apply for and to be accepted to do. It's changing. So you get that. Then when you get to politics, for example, our political systems have a role to play in that, you know? Starting from, let's say, primaries. Party primaries are manipulated for favorite sons, not daughters. Our political cultures are violent. There are insults. And that becomes very inhospitable to women. But then also, the type of electoral system, research is showing. So the type of electoral system and the use of electoral gender quotas makes a difference to whether or not women would be able to participate more fully in politics. So Ghana's electoral system, and you know we have very few women in parliament, and Ghana's electoral system is a single member district or first past the post system. So it's woman unfriendly because it becomes very competitive. A few years ago, when the New Patriotic Party tried to say, okay, let's have some safe seats for women, so that they'll be more competitive, you know, the party rebelled, you know, because the men don't want to lose their advantage.
Of course.
You know. The more woman-friendly electoral system used around the world, in some countries, including in Rwanda, which has the highest representation of women,
yes,
is a proportional representation electoral system. You see? Because with that, if you have a party list, you can decide we will have X number of women on the party list, X number of men on the party list, or else. Another way also is to have a gender quota. You know, Kwame Nkrumah had a gender quota that allowed women to get into politics when he was our president. So I think about we ended up with about 10 women in parliament. Then the latest example of why a proportional representational electoral system is what will get women in politics in Africa is Sierra Leone. Because when Sierra Leone had the goal of electing 30% of women, and they went from a single member district system to a proportional representation system, what happened? The parliament increase, women's representation in parliament increase from, it doubled, you know, I think it increased from something like almost 13%, less than 13% to almost 30%, you see. So we come to the whole issue that is often seen as controversial and fraught of affirmative action. Affirmative action to be understood as the kinds of things that you need to do in order to correct historical disadvantages for a group of people. In this case, it's women. So you saw affirmative action being used in the US, or now diversity, inclusion, and equality
Equity.
Sort of arrangements, in order that the system that has always favored the dominant group and will always favor the dominant group because they have their leg up, you know, there's a sort of inclusion. It allows, it creates opportunities for other groups, you see. And that's the issue when it comes to women. But having said that, when societies, countries are able to address that, after a while, it's not needed anymore. Why? Because one of the things that affirmative action does, or one of the things that happens when you see people who are not usually holding certain positions get into those positions, it's a role modeling sort of effect. So I didn't think that as a woman, I could become a politician. Right. However, I now see a lot of women in the political space. I as a woman, am mentored by other women who are politicians. And so it's no longer a no-go area. So what I'm saying is that it's important to break the glass ceilings in leadership positions, whether it's political, academia, in the media, in order to shift gender dynamics. And then it's important, once that happens, that there's a certain mentoring that happens as well, and a certain conscious effort to look for capable women. Because again, if you don't look for capable women, then what happens is it becomes a tokenism. So we need women to occupy, X percentage of women to occupy this position, and we just go and pick any kind of woman. Then they are bound to fail because they were not qualified in the first place. And then you come around and you see, when we give women a chance, they fail.
Yeah.
As though
men
don't fail all the time. As though men don't fail all the time, you know. Yeah. But women pay a heavier price for failing.
For failing, of course. And that's an interesting point you bring up. And I think here it goes, because you described, I think, very well the structural barriers to women entering politics. However, what about some of the psychological barriers? A couple of weeks ago, Ibrahim Nye, who's the Deputy Foreign Minister of Liberia, was on this show. And we talked about the presidency of Ellen Sirleaf Johnson and how that was possible. And I remember he said that during the campaign, her first campaign, the first time she was elected, that the campaign came up with a slogan saying, "Ellen is our man." And I found that really intriguing. And he said they came up with the slogan because they acknowledged the fact, they realized the fact that, okay, most Liberians felt that, quote unquote, only a man can be a proper leader, a proper president. And so her campaign responded to that by saying, okay, if they want a man, Ellen is the man. And I think what that played to is playing to the idea that, okay, while there might be some biological difference, while biologically she may be a female, mentally, maybe in terms of her capability, she's actually a male. That seemed to me what they were playing on then by saying, you know, Ellen is our man. So do you perceive similar problems in Ghana with regards to perceptions about female ability to be leaders? Do people imagine that a woman can be a leader in terms of, you know, a woman could run this country, or are there issues around that in Ghana?
Yeah, we haven't had a woman president yet. We just elected our first woman vice president. So indeed, in the minds of people, and it will start at the party level, you know, they'll have to accept that a woman can be presidential material, okay?
That's
and
the word.
I'm not sure that has... That is very easy for a lot of influential people in the political space to see yet. They have accepted it in other professions. So I'm sure that with time, and again, with more women in leadership positions in the political space, people will begin to see the capabilities of women, but we're just beginning. I mean, there were times when people didn't think that women could be doctors or engineers.
Sure.
But now nobody bats an eyelid. Mm. At the University of Ghana, where I work, the University of Ghana was established in 1948, in the colonial era. It was only in 2021 that we had our first female vice chancellor. But now, but before then, University of Cape Coast had had a woman vice chancellor, but it took a long time. But now, when you look at the governance space at my university, guess what? It is heavily tilted towards women. So right now, the chancellor of our university, who only became the first woman chancellor in 2018, is a woman, of course. You know, the vice chancellor is a woman. Our registrar is a woman. She's only the second woman registrar in the history of Legon, but she's a woman at the moment. You know, our chair of council was a woman. Our finance director is a woman. Our head of our prestigious foremost medical research unit, a Noguchi Memorial Research Institute, is a woman. And so there's been such a shift. And when I joined the university in 1993, that wasn't the case at all. You hardly saw women in top leadership in the university. It was in 1996 that we had our first pro vice chancellor. And then after that, really not much happened, you know. But now you see women as deans, provost, and like I just described. And so there's so then after that, that glass ceiling has been broken. Women will see that there's that possibilities in those spaces and begin to actively plan towards attaining them. Okay. At first, they may not have, but now they'll plan. The young academics will say, I'd like to be a vice chancellor, and this is what it will take to be a vice chancellor. I need to volunteer to for more administrative roles. I need to aspire to do A, B, C, D in order that I am well placed. Then also what happens? Now there's a bigger pool of women to draw from, okay? Yeah. So the competition will not only be one woman competing and many men. So let's say a position opens up, there are five men and one woman, because the pool of qualified women or capable women or motivated women, because sometimes they are qualified and capable, but they're not motivated for all kinds of reasons. But that pool becomes bigger and there's a lot more women to draw from. It takes time. But it takes a certain conscious effort to try and bring about gender parity in order that there's a more qualified talent pool from which to draw when leadership positions become open.
Okay, interesting. And I think you touched on two sort of dimensions there, because you talked about other people, so males essentially, recognizing that a woman can do X job, but then also you talked about other women seeing that, oh wow, so there's a woman doing X job, that means there is the possibility that I could also thrive in that space. So if there's been one woman who's been a dean of a university or department or a minister or president, then that means I could also do it. So it's actually needed for both things. One, for the males to see, oh yes, this can actually happen and it works perfectly. And also for the other women to see and say, oh, wow, I can actually also do that since someone has already done it.
Yes, but also for the, you see, it's not only males who think that a woman may not be able to do a particular job. Sometimes women also, because they have been nurtured and socialized, actually, socialized to think that certain jobs are the preserved of males. And therefore, sometimes it's other women not so sure that, you know, that woman will be a good leader. So it's not just men. It's men, but it's also it can also be other women, just because the society has socialized us to think in that way. And so how we socialize the younger generation then becomes very important. Okay. And socializing our female and male children in ways that doesn't perpetuate that mindset, that patriarchal mindset, you know, and also that misogynistic mindset that can hold women back.
And do you see that changing now in Ghana with regards to younger generations? You talked already about some of this shift in academia and other places. And I have to tell you, you know, if we're talking about academia, this isn't restricted to definitely, you know, to Ghana or African spaces where it's been often male dominated for a long time. I remember when I started out at the University of Sheffield in the UK, when I was still doing a PhD there, there was a running joke among the academics there. They said, wow, and this was around, let's say, 2018, 2019. They said, oh, not so long ago in this department of politics here at the University of Sheffield, there were more lecturers called Steve than female lecturers. That used to be something they said, and they were talking about, you know, not such a distant past. So this is, you know, this a general problem we could speak of. And so going back again to Ghana, do you see that, you know, changing it with regards to the younger generation? And do you see any of the indications? Because one thing which is often talked about now in the West is that there is now a sort of backlash to feminism, etc.
Yes.
We see that, you know, in the US, sort
yes.
of, you know, men saying, oh, you know, hang on a minute. There's all this talk about, you know, female emancipation and women, etc., etc. But what about us? We are being left out. Or actually, you know, feminists are not allowing us to speak our minds anymore. We can't speak freely. You know, you would have heard about these kinds of discussions in Western countries. Is that also going on right now in Ghana? Is there that kind of tension amongst younger people along that male-female nexus because of some of these issues we've been talking about?
I think that generally speaking, in Ghana or in a lot of African countries, the backlash is not as evident as, well, at least to me, as in other countries, including places like the US, but it doesn't mean that it's not there, because there's always going to be a certain level of resistance. I told you about when the New Patriotic Party quite a few years ago tried to get affirmative action at the primaries for women. There was a backlash, okay?
Mm-hmm.
So that backlash, the possibility of a backlash is always there. I'd like to think, because I'm an optimist, that the younger generation will be better than our generation. However, I see disturbing signs of misogyny, particularly in social media. You see, so I don't know whether it's the nature of social media to fuel bad behavior because there's anonymity. Face to face and person to person, I think that people restrain themselves because they are not anonymous and they know better. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
But the anonymity that social media provides, nurtures or encourages a certain kind of behavior that is very misogynistic towards women. And therefore you would say rolling back gains that we think we've achieved. In the formal space, in workplaces, you're not going to see that.
Yeah.
Very much. But in other places, like I said, like in social media, you are going to see certain language, because young people get captivated. Well, not only young people, everybody can be influenced by the echo chambers that they inhabit and the echo chambers that they feed on for their information, you see.
Unfortunately, not so great, but I mean, that's a great point you make there. And finally then, Prof, what's one piece, if you had to give one piece of advice to young Africans who want to lead, who want to take their societies to where we all want our African societies to be, prosperous, stable, what piece of advice would you give to that young African?
That young African should commit to integrity. You see, character. We need people who have character, who have integrity to lead us. Because without that, you know, we are sunk. And for that young African to understand that it is their responsibility as Africans to make their countries better than they found them. Nobody will come from the outside to do it for them. And the world is we live in a global village, but it's shrinking. The borders are being tightened. Okay. So it's not so easy for you to pick up from your country and say, I'm seeking greener pastures everywhere. You better make where you live the greener pasture. And that can only happen if younger people are more civic minded and more engaged in the political system. And I don't mean they have to run for elected office, but they have to be engaged and they have to be in the civic space and they have to find ways of holding those who wield power accountable, of course, in peaceful ways, but they cannot be passive. They cannot wait every 4 years, I'll go and vote and that's it, and then come back and sleep. They are not going to get a good society if they are passive. They have to be active citizens.
Professor Audrey Gatsekpo, thank you very much for joining us on the show today.
Thank you, Remy, for having me. It's been enjoyable talking to you.
Thank you for listening to How to Become a Leader in Africa. If you enjoyed today's conversation, don't forget to subscribe and like and review the podcast on your favorite platform. It helps more people discover these vital discussions. You can also visit our website to drop your comments and suggestions, which we always welcome. Join us next time as we continue exploring the logic of leadership in African societies. Till then, take care of yourselves.